This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Reaper, written by Will White, performed by Travis Baldry. Prologue. Information restricted. Personal record 8154. Authorization required to access. Authorization confirmed 008. Osriel. Beginning record. Osmanthus Aurelius looked up into the ash falling from the sky and knew he'd failed. His descendants had died in droves, trusting in him. Techniques flashed through the air from miles away, and the earth trembled beneath his feet. He had done what he could to protect the innocents, but there was no bringing them back now. He could only break things, and once again, he hadn't broken the right things quickly enough. He almost left the world immediately, abandoning what remained of his family to clean up after his failure. But he had not yet finished his work in Cradle. He needed to leave something behind. He looked down in his hand, where a small barrier in the shape of an orb contained a fragment of his power. To the mortal eye, it resembled a black hole contained in a glass bead a little bigger than his thumbnail. This marble carried his parting message to his family. So far, no one had listened to him. But he could try again. One last time. Record complete. Chapter 1. With his remnant arm in a scripted sling, Lyndon stood motionless on a 1,000-mile cloud. This one was rust-red, similar to the one he'd used when leaving Sacred Valley for the first time. This time, he tried not to dwell on all the devastation below him.
"This is not very dignified, young one," Elder Whisper protested.
Lyndon had the giant five-tailed snow fox bound up in wind aura and floating behind him. Now it looked as though the sacred beast was being carried in a giant, invisible fist.
"Apologies, Elder. I'm not certain I could transfer us directly with any precision, so please bear with the indignity for a short time."
"I don't see why I could not have ridden my own cloud."
Lyndon had another 1,000-mile cloud and could make one easily enough, but he didn't trust Elder Whisper to stay in place. Lyndon could see through illusions now, but he was still exhausted. He didn't want to spend his every second staring to prevent the Elder from sneaking away.
"We're almost there."
Gripped by air though he was, the white fox still had enough control to stretch his head further and whisper into Lyndon's ear.
"I offered you the secrets of monarchs, young Lyndon. They are not for just anyone to hear."
"I'm not bringing you to just anyone."
Lyndon's red cloud drifted upwards toward a much larger island of blue cloud madra, with a blocky, castle-like slab of stone on it, Zeal's unnamed cloud fortress. As soon as he sat down on the edge of the cloud base, another cloud zipped up to him. This one was no bigger than his fist, and it was driven by an ocean-blue woman about a foot tall. She glared at him, and her voice was like a clatter of dropped pans. Lyndon dipped his head to Little Blue.
"Forgiveness. I didn't want to disturb you."
She would have known that he was fine, and generally where he'd gone, but that didn't mean she enjoyed being left behind. She leaped off the cloud onto his shoulder, chattering at him not to forget her again.
"Your Sylvan River Seed has power similar to your own," Elder Whisper noted. "So that's how you expanded your pure madra to catch up to your peers."
Little Blue shot Whisper an indifferent glance, then ignored him. Lyndon released the Elder so they could walk up to Zeal's home together. There were scripts all over the territory to protect them from being spied on by the spiritual senses of others, but Lyndon carried a ward key. Mercy and Zeal were still recovering, and the biggest surprise was that he didn't feel Aethon at all. When he entered the plain gray house, Yeren was already standing in the entry, looking down at him. Her red eyes were filled with worry.
"Thought you'd be gone for longer than 2.5 seconds."
Her concern brought up the reality he'd been trying to avoid. A purple mass of spiritual power rested at the base of his skull, weak and unclear. Dross, or what was left of him. Those thoughts were razor sharp, and Lyndon stopped handling them before they cut him too badly. "Whisper is one of the elders of my clan," Lyndon said, gesturing to the fox behind him. He had information about the labyrinth that he wanted to share, and after that, I have something to show you as well. She looked confused, but nodded to Elder Whisper.
"Whisper, huh? You that quiet?"
Another Elder Whisper appeared behind her, resting his jaws on her shoulder and whispering into her ear.
"I can be when I wish."
The original Elder had made himself invisible to complete the illusion, but she kept her eyes on him.
"Not much to it when you look hard enough, is it?"
Elder Whisper sighed and dropped the illusions.
"I am nowhere near advanced enough to deceive eyes of your caliber."
"And yet," Lyndon began, but he cut the sentence off before he said, "and yet you held the Sword Sage's private void space open for years."
"Some things are not included in what we traditionally call advancement," the fox said.
He followed Lyndon through a door and up a nearby set of stairs, and together the three of them walked into an open room at the top. This was the control room of Zeal's Cloud Fortress, and it was smaller and dimmer than Lyndon's. The one on Windfall resembled the common room of a house more than a cloud ship control room, complete with a couch and chairs, but this one was just a wide panel of scripts and precisely one window on each wall. Yeren shut the door, and Lyndon sent his spiritual perception through the ship, making sure the scripts protecting them were active.
"We shouldn't be overheard here," Lyndon said.
"We wouldn't have been overheard back at the tomb,"
Whisper pointed out, and Yeren glanced at Lyndon.
"As I said, I'm not the only one that needs to hear this."
Little Blue chimed out, asking about Aethon. Her name for him sounded like a cheery whistle.
"Does anyone know where Aethon is?"
When no one responded, Lyndon went on. "Then he'll have to catch up." Aethon would catch up, Lyndon was certain. Usually it was Lyndon trying to catch up to him. Whisper settled onto his haunches.
"This story would go a lot easier if we had some fish."
"Apologies, but I'm not sure Zeal has had time to restock."
It had been only a day since an all-out battle against the Dread Gods, and they had ferried a number of refugees from Sacred Valley in that time. Many of them had been hungry. Even if Zeal did have food left, Lyndon didn't know where to find it.
"Then I suppose I must go without."
5 white tails lashed at the air, and Elder Whisper looked from Lyndon to Little Blue to Yeren as though doubting their credentials.
"As I told young Lyndon here, I can lead you toward one of the truths of this world, how to kill the Dread Gods."
There was a stretch of silence before Yeren audibly scoffed. She waited longer than Lyndon had expected.
"You a monarch in disguise, are you?"
Yeren asked.
"I am old, and I have lived above the labyrinth for almost my entire life. There are secrets within that make the monarchs tremble."
Lyndon wanted to bring out the canister marked with the symbol of House Aurelius, but even behind their scripts he worried it would attract distant attention.
"The maze beneath us is the birthplace of the Dread Gods,"
Elder Whisper went on.
"But it is far more ancient even than they. Secrets creep out from time to time where those with insight can collect them."
Lyndon wanted details, but first he had to see if Whisper's knowledge was worth anything.
"How do we kill the Dread Gods?"
"You cannot simply disassemble them physically. You must destroy them on a fundamental level, sever the origin of their existence."
Lyndon looked to Yeren, whose scowl was melting into a thoughtful expression. They'd heard terms like this before, when the Abaddon was describing penance, a weapon that had instantly slain a monarch.
"I do not understand the mechanics well myself," Whisper said. "These are ideas I have stitched together from fractured memories and broken whispers. But as I see it, any who could kill the Dread Gods directly have already moved on from this world. Even the monarchs combined could not do it. However, there is something anchoring the Dread Gods to life. If you remove it, they will be made mortal.
One tail pointed to Linden.
No weaker, you understand, but mortal.
What is this anchor? Linden asked.
And where is it?
Yaren followed, with a tone as though she already knew. Little Blue gave a chime, expressing her reluctance to fight another Dread God, whether it was mortal or not. Elder Whisper looked to Yaren.
He waits at the bottom of the labyrinth, deeper than anyone has gone in years uncounted. Your master contended with his will, and it was that which weakened him, beyond even the field suppressing his power.
Yaren stiffened, but Whisper had already moved on to Linden.
He is the first product of the experiments that resulted in the creation of the Dread Gods. In the myths that tell of his existence, he is sometimes called the fifth Dread God, and sometimes the first. The father of hunger, some call him. The slumbering wraith. But I have seen notes from his observers calling him Subject One.
Linden's mind flicked back to the old notes he'd once studied with Fisher Gesha, wishing Dross was here to help him sort his thoughts. He had questions, but the Elder had turned to Little Blue.
No one should look forward to fighting Dread Gods. It is not a pleasant task, but they cannot be allowed to rampage forever.
Linden and the others had done battle with the Wandering Titan at its weakest, and it had taken everything they had just to convince it to trample someone else. It was the equivalent of curling up and letting an opponent wail on you with their fists in the hopes that they tired themselves out and walked away. For the moment, it had worked, in the sense that the Titan had chosen not to bother with them anymore. It could come back at any time. But there wasn't much left in Sacred Valley to defend.
Can we get into the labyrinth? Linden asked.
There is a way inside. The Sage of the Endless Sword took advantage of it, and so can you.
Linden stared into the distant clouds outside the window and thought. His arm could use repairs, and there were countless people from Sacred Valley that lacked protection and guidance. He was concerned about Orthos. The whole team needed rest, and he needed to get his family and his own cloud fortress back from Moongrave. From his pocket, he pulled out a clear marble with a single blue candle flame burning at its center. He turned it in his fingers. It seemed forever ago that Suriel had given him that marble, but at the same time, like almost no time had passed at all. He had expected his task to take him the rest of his life. Now it was over. Sacred Valley, or what was left of it, was saved. He wasn't sure whether to consider it a success or a failure, but either way, his mission was done. He had started to climb a mountain, expecting it to take decades, only to suddenly find himself at the peak. Maybe it was that realization that helped him feel how tired he really was. He had time now. Time to rest, time to spend with Yaren, time to practice soulsmithing, time to learn what it meant to be a sage, time to get to know his family again. Though he wasn't quite sure how he felt about that. But there was one concern that outweighed the rest. Dross. Aethon had said that Dross might come back on his own, but Linden couldn't sit by and wait to see what happened. He would learn as much as he could. At least now he had the time.
There should be plenty of soulsmithing records inside the labyrinth, right?
Linden asked Elder Whisper. The fox shot him a look.
It is a repository of ancient truths, as well as the home and workplace of the greatest soulsmiths in history. You could study there for the next 500 years and never reach the depths of their understanding.
Gratitude. Then I intend to learn whatever I can from the labyrinth, but we still need to discuss our next actions. Together.
Elder Whisper raised his eyebrows in an expression that wouldn't have looked out of place on a human face.
I expected more commitment from you.
There are too many questions left. For one thing, if you know about this, Why haven't the monarchs taken action?
I have had dreams.
Lyndon blinked at the fox's abrupt change in topic, but Elder Whisper only continued.
Once in a long while, when the heavens allow, I can catch a glimpse of fate in my dreams. And when I dream of seeking out monarchs, I see death. My death, always. Sometimes also the death of our home.
What causes it? Lyndon asked. Which monarchs?
I regret to say I cannot tell, but much is unclear to me. The monarchs should not need me to petition them in any case. They should know much more about the contents of the labyrinth than I do, and yet they have refused to move. This is one of the answers you should seek in the depths.
I will, Lyndon said. But I'm not going by myself.
Yaren gave a decisive nod.
Numbers are of limited use in the labyrinth. You may...
Elder Whisper continued speaking, but his words faded to the back of Lyndon's awareness. Something invaded his consciousness. A message, but deeper and softer than words, impossibly distant. He felt regret, apology, someone urging him to do his best and to survive at all costs. If he had to interpret the message in words, he would have bet it said, "I'm sorry. Hold on." He stretched out his spiritual perception, looking for the source of the message, and Yaren noticed. Her spirit sharpened as she prepared herself for battle.
"We about to bleed somebody?"
"No, I'm sorry. Did you sense something a minute ago?"
"Before you jumped like a dog trying to fly."
She raised an eyebrow.
"If there's anything here, I'm blind to it. And I'm not leaping to fight invisible enemies today, I'll tell you that. Ask me tomorrow."
He shook his head. It had only been a vague impression, and it had passed anyway.
"Apologies, I think I'm on edge."
"Can't imagine why."
Lyndon rolled Cyril's marble in his fingers again. Somehow, the message had felt like the feelings that radiated from the blue flame, and the comfort that usually came off the transparent orb seemed somehow weaker than usual. Another sign of his own anxiety, surely. Unless... There came a thunk as the door on the first floor swung open, interrupting Lyndon's thoughts. A voice echoed up from below.
"Oh no, I missed something," Athan cried. "Quickly, repeat your entire conversation before you forget a word."
Deep in the labyrinth, Regan Shen withdrew a drudge from a pouch at his belt and set it free. He had cobbled this one together specifically for this mission, and it was made to exist in this low-energy environment. The construct unfolded from a pocket-sized rectangle of compressed madra into something resembling a mechanical dog, then began to sniff around an ancient laboratory. The room was large enough to contain a flight of dragons, but was decorated like an expensive study. Lots of polished wood and plush cushions, with empty windows that would probably once have displayed illusionary scenery of the outside. Around the center of this laboratory were empty cages of scripted glass, which would certainly once have contained experimental subjects. Time-shriveled husks that had once been dreadbeasts remained in some, while others had been broken from the outside, or from the inside. The laboratory had long waited in disarray, with desks destroyed, papers scattered, and holes scorched in the walls. There were preservation scripts on everything, but most of them had failed, leaving odd scenarios where one half of a sheet of paper might have been aged and yellowed into illegibility, while the other half looked as though it had been scribed that morning. Papers and scrolls were of limited value to Regan Shen, though he scooped them all up anyway. He was looking for ways deeper into the labyrinth, so unless he found a map, there wasn't much here that could help him. Here and there, his drudge spotted what he was looking for. Dream tablets. It brought the treasures back in its teeth, dropping the stones at his feet. Some resembled hand-sized gemstones, while others were more like dull slabs the size of his face, but he could see their dream aura as a purplish, chaotic haze. Ordinarily, his spiritual perception would have crashed over this room in a wave, and anything he sought would fly to him on wings of wind aura. But the deeper he went, the more effect the suppression field had on him. In some ways, the monarch Regan Shen was now weaker than if he had never trained in the sacred arts a day in his life. But he had his own methods. A gray-white ghost oozed up from the floor in front of him, its arms dragging the ground, its jaw hanging loose. Empty eye sockets sought him, and it groaned in pure hunger. It resembled a remnant, but was actually a striker technique, carrying enough will of its own that it acted more like a spirit. An attack from the devourer itself, the slumbering wraith, subject one. With his powers suppressed, Regan Shen still might have enough authority to disperse the technique, but power he lost down here would be difficult to regain. Historically, most of those who had explored this labyrinth had done so by staying inside only a short time. That would be Shen's preferred approach as well, but every time he left and re-entered the labyrinth, he risked discovery once again. So he had prepared to stay longer than anyone had since this place sealed itself so long ago. He brought tools. Regan Shen unclipped another construct from his belt. This one unfolded into a shining orange-yellow launcher that wrapped around his wrist. He pointed it at the ghoul and triggered the binding. The launcher construct was herald level, and thus powerful enough to reduce this huge room to ash and cave in the structure of the surrounding building. After being carried around in the labyrinth for so long, it merely disintegrated the spirit. With businesslike motions, Shen folded up the launcher again. If the weapon hadn't remained in a scripted container for so long, it would have faded away already. It was only due to its faultless construction and some binding scripts that it worked at all. He would have greatly preferred to store his weapons in a void space, but those were difficult to open in this place, so he preserved energy by strapping script-sealed devices all over him. If everything went according to his plan, he would only have to open up his void space once a month. That would last him more than long enough to reach the bottom. He would empty this place if it took him a decade, because in the end, he would do what no one else had ever done, and seize control of the greatest weapons ever created. The Dread Gods. All five of them. After the retreat of the Wandering Titan, the Bleeding Phoenix had retreated north. Akura Malis had regrouped, gathered her power, and followed. She met the Bleeding Phoenix as an equal, striking it with her bow like a staff. The blow landed on the phoenix's oozing red body, and the Dread God shrieked. The sound carried enough hostility that Malice had to brace herself against it, even as a bloody red dragon burst through the phoenix's body. Northstrider's attack. The Bleeding Phoenix responded with a simple striker technique, a lance of light from its open beak, wider than a river. To others, the attack would appear large enough to swallow cities, but Malice threw herself in front and blocked it on her shoulder. The pressure on her amethyst armor increased, straining her spirit and causing her to push more Madra to keep the gemstone structure stable, but she spared Northstrider from having to deal with it, and he had taken the opportunity to appear behind the Dread God and tear another chunk out of it with a blow that blasted out the air for miles. The phoenix's eyes shone, and it screamed again. This time, Malice's heart tightened. They were playing this close. Not only would they run out of power faster than the Dread God would, but if they damaged it too much more, its brothers would show up. The Titan was nearby, and if they managed to kill it, the situation would get even worse. She reserved a bit of her fury for Regan Shen, who had forced her to fight a Dread God in her territory. Again. For the second, no, third time in 5 years. If only there were another arrowhead around to deal with him, too. Northstrider had taken quite a beating from the phoenix already, so he was only too happy to back up and let Malice trade blows with the Dread God in her towering armored form. She landed a few lighthouse-sized arrows of crystalline blue Madra before the phoenix's simple brain got the message. This prey could bite back. It wasn't worth it. This was how fights between monarchs and Dread Gods normally proceeded. One of the great beasts would wander somewhere inconvenient, and then whoever owned that territory would fight until the Dread God decided the fight wasn't worthwhile and wandered somewhere less valuable. But it was such a delicate balance to strike. The dread gods hit at least as hard as any monarch, and they were sturdy enough that Malice could never kill one alone before having to flee herself. It was a bit like a copper driving off a fully grown bear with a whip. It was better than pushing them to the brink, though. If they pushed them too far, the dread gods would join forces, or worse, they could awaken. Malice had not been a monarch during the Dread War, but she had seen the memories of others. So now, when the phoenix gave another irritated cry and retreated north, she stopped and let it happen. The crimson sky rolled away, and she relaxed. Let the Tidewalker Herald deal with the Dread God for a change. He had supported Regan Shen too much in the past, and now he would pay for it. When the bleeding phoenix was no longer visible, even to her, she let her armor fade into great clouds of shining violet essence that rose into the clouds. She hovered in the air, stretching her arms and spirit at once. She got far too little exercise as a monarch, and her armor was a serious burden, at least against a real opponent. Northstrider appeared next to her, clothes rumpled and golden eyes scowling.
"Good thing I was here to help," Malice said. "You look terrible."
He looked the same as always, unshaven and unkempt, with scavenged clothing, like a homeless king, but what she felt from him was another story. His spirit was strained and weak, and she was sure his mind was on the verge of collapse. He had fought bitterly. Northstrider ground his jaw, and she detected the heat of real anger.
"Do you know what you were risking, letting those children face the Titan? May I remind you that one of those children is my own? You were supposed to replace Yeren Aurelius in driving off the Dreadcod, not join her." "I thought things were proceeding quite well until—"
Malice's voice gained an icy chill, with all her hatred boiling behind it.
"He stuck his paws where they were not wanted."
Northstrider crossed black-scaled arms.
"If anything, that proves how high the stakes are. Now we know for certain he can rouse and direct the Dreadcods, and he revealed that card to get rid of a pack of lords." "He has been claiming that ability for years now. I suspect that show wasn't for us."
By moving the phoenix, Regan Shen had not only threatened to remove valuable members of the next generation, including Malice's own daughter, but he had proved his claims to the neutral monarchs. Northstrider and Malice had been forced to spend their own time and energy, so he had exhausted them at no cost or risk to himself. A fine move. This was exactly the sort of price she had expected when she gave up Fury. For a while, she would be vulnerable. But she could endure, and when she did, she would be in a better situation than ever.
"Take care of those children,"
Northstrider said flatly, which pricked her pride.
"Do you think I, of all people, need a lecture from you on how to protect my own family?"
His perception stretched out into the distance.
"Perhaps you need lessons in spatial transfer."
She reached out on her own, and with shock felt Yeren almost immediately. Mercy, Aethon, and Linden were all there too, their presence is a bit fainter than Yeren's. Had they just arrived? Yeren may have taken the Moonlight Bridge back, if it had recovered its full capabilities, but how had the others returned so quickly? The Void Icon had a good connection to spatial abilities, but if Linden had taken them all this way unaided, he was a prodigy the likes of which the world hadn't seen in millennia. She realized the truth after only a few more moments of examination. Regan Shen's anchor. Malice spared another moment of anger for the lion. Even his belongings were opposing her now.
I suppose I should return their cloud ship," Malice said, more lightly than she felt. "Leave them to me, and concern yourself instead with Shen's next move."
Northstrider looked into the horizon where the phoenix vanished, and his reflective black orb appeared over his shoulder. It flashed with Madra as it communicated with him.
"I'm going into seclusion again," he said after a moment. "Fate has been moving erratically."
Malice nodded. She could only agree. She had far more talent in reading the future than he did, the shadow icon being more connected to fate than any of his, but he had his own means.
I put what forces I can spare at your disposal. The Wastelanders have agreed to protect the Black Flame Empire in my absence, and the Beast King and his fellow heralds will help you keep the cults in check.
So gracious of you.
Fury had driven off the Dreadgod cults, but not too far. They were drifting around her territory, behaving themselves for now, but she had to keep her eye on them. If Northstrider was vanishing again on one of his projects, then she would need help to protect herself from both the awakened Dreadgods and their cults. The unaffiliated heralds who occasionally answered to Northstrider would go a long way toward helping her maintain stability in the continent.
How long will you be gone this time? She asked.
Difficult to say. The more I can refine my Oracle Codex, the better odds I have of removing Shen myself, and the more clearly I can see the future.
Gold eyes turned to her.
Unless you can share more details than you already have.
She smirked at him, letting him know she enjoyed having sight where he was blind.
As I said, the Dreadgods loom larger than they have before. All other possibilities are scattered and unpredictable, too vague to lean on.
He grunted.
You may call me if the worst should occur.
Oh, do I have your permission? I will keep an eye on the future and the other monarchs while I maintain my cordon on the labyrinth entrances. He won't be able to act without us seeing him now, and time is on our side.
The Dreadgods would run out of energy soon if they kept up this level of activity. The cults were expending energy without gaining any back, and Malice was slowly absorbing the half of the continent the Gold Dragons had once ruled. The longer this stalemate went on, the more territory she would claim. All she had to do was wait.
We'll see, Northstrider responded.
Then he tore open the fabric of the world and flowed into the way.
Always so rude, Malice murmured.
Then she stretched her awareness out for hundreds of miles around her. There was no one who mattered. She didn't like to do this when she wasn't fully secured, but Northstrider had her wondering. So Malice slipped into the world of night and summoned shadows of the future. Chapter 2 Information restricted. Personal record 0013. Authorization required to access. Authorization confirmed. 008. Azriel. Beginning record. In the legends of the ancient Rosegold continent, long forgotten by the current inhabitants of Cradle, there is a mythical location that contains all the secrets of the sacred arts, a buried city of infinite insight, a child's tale. Anyone who finds the city and walks its streets will gain secret techniques of surpassing power, will never face any bottlenecks when advancing, and will understand secret wisdom of the heavens that will allow them to ascend. There is no historical precedent for this location. It's purely a myth. But at one point on the Rosegold continent, it was a common topic of discussion. If you sought easy advancement or tried to refine your path, it was said that you were seeking Aurelia. Osmanthus, a boy named after a flower, was said to be seeking Aurelia from the time he was a child. From his earliest years, he ran through the tunnels of the mountain in which he was born, looking for secrets in those dark caves. Even at the initial stages of advancement, later known as Copper, he had discernment and understanding far beyond his peers. He astonished his tutors with questions about the nature and origin of vital aura, questions they were nowhere near advanced enough to answer. His control of Madra made him a prodigy in his own right, so there was no lack of teachers competing to take him as a student. This was a relief to his mother, who had no money to subsidize the advancement of a powerful sacred artist. At Copper, Osmanthus was celebrated for his skill. He was popular not just among his tutors, but among those his age. At Iron, Osmanthus became famous in his generation. He designed and perfected his own iron body and was once again said to be seeking Aurelia. Everyone expected great things. It was at Jade that Osmanthus began to notice a problem. The others his age were still copper. That wasn't entirely true. Some of those from wealthy families, or from organizations that focused exclusively on the sacred arts, had been sponsored directly to Logold. But the ones he'd grown up with, those who had only recently been his friends, were two entire stages down from him. He could no longer play games with them, as he would win. He couldn't study with them, as he had already outstripped many of their teachers in theory, and they began to avoid him. For Osmanthus, it was only a minor grief. His path lay ahead of him, full of possibility, and everyone told him what wonders he would accomplish. With his spiritual perception now open, there was a whole new world bared to his mind. He had decided the details of his path by Logold, refining it during endless hours in the library. He chose techniques of pure destruction. Why settle for inefficiency? That led to another troubling trend for Osmanthus. The sacred arts in Cradle tend to focus on combat applications because of the never-ending competition for resources, but soon there was no one under the Lord realm who could compete against him. He was not shunned for this. Far from it, his master and those from his homeland were ecstatic at this young genius. But he was always alone. When he went into the wilderness seeking spirits or natural treasures, it was easier to go himself. Someone else would just slow him down. While Osmanthus was not entirely content with his solitude, he knew it was only temporary. He couldn't be the greatest genius in the world. Somewhere he would find someone who would keep up with him. Until then, he would slow down. He gave up his spear for a broom, but he didn't mind that. He liked being the only sacred artist in the world to fight with a broom. It had style. After reaching Underlord, he grew in knowledge and insight and power. He studied the nature of soulfire and proved its connection to deeper truths by manifesting an icon of his choice in front of a panel of renowned scholars. The broom icon. Rather than impressed, the scholars were crushed. Osmanthus had made their entire lives into a joke, publicly humiliating them. No less than 3 of them killed themselves within a week. This greatly disturbed Osmanthus. In addition to advancement, Osmanthus also turned his genius to other aspects of the sacred arts. He became known as a reliable refiner and one of the greatest soulsmiths of his generation. He was more satisfied with this avenue of progress, and he began investigating the great soulsmiths of the past. This was the path for him, he decided. He would become known as a creator, a researcher, one who built. His path was most suited for creating weapons, which did not bother him. He never lost his admiration for those who kept the world clean, and one of the most hideous plagues in the world was the population of dreadbeasts that roamed the countryside, feeding and spewing out more of their kind. With his weapons, he would clean the countryside. He found an ancient labyrinth built by the original Court of 7 before their ascension. He researched their understanding, growing in knowledge and power, and he built weapons. To better understand his creations, he sought knowledge of death. He even created a device that would kill and revive him. He did not realize what a catalyst that would be. As the creator of the world's deadliest weapons, when he killed and revived himself, he instantly manifested the death icon. Not what he had sought to achieve. Osmanthus found it now even easier to create deadly weapons. Too easy. He could create reality-warping weapons on the level of the Abaddon before even ascending from the iteration, and with his every accomplishment, he grew more alone. No one could match his accomplishments, no one could face him in battle, and no one could understand his insights into the world beyond. He abandoned his weapons. He focused on another of his talents, his sight. When he advanced to Monarch, he developed the bloodline ability to see. Osmanthus was so relieved that he wept. This was the ability that he wanted to define his legacy, and he would leave his descendants with the ability to see as he did, to one day catch up to him. He named his house after the city he had always sought. The Aurelius family should always seek greater insight. And when he finally ascended, He left a beacon behind, a measure of his power, like a black hole sealed in a transparent barrier that resembled glass. When someone appeared from his family with enough talent to join him, they would ascend with the marble, and he would know. He expected to wait a generation, perhaps two or three. But he was certain that very soon, House Aurelius would be a dynasty that spread to the heavens themselves. Record complete. Lyndon shouted Northstrider's name into the sky. He begged, he pleaded, he bargained, and he even threatened, politely. The monarch never responded. Without his help, Lyndon's chances of repairing Dross fell significantly. But Lyndon could try again. Until Dross awakened, he had time to research. In the meantime, he brought Yeren to the Sword Sage's void space. Lyndon had expected Yeren to follow him out of curiosity, but the more he hinted that he had something to show her, the more reluctant she became. He dropped several hints, expecting her to sprint ahead of him. Instead, the more she learned, the slower her feet moved. It was as though she dreaded finding something her master left behind. Lyndon marched into the half-destroyed tomb. A chunk of its roof caved in and one of its pillars cracked. He had to pick his way around pieces of debris that looked like they had been deposited here by a hurricane. Yeren paused at the entrance, at the top of the stairs where she had once fought her master's remnant. The cold wind grabbed the lock of red hair over her eyes, which she hadn't had all that time ago.
"Is this gonna kill me if I don't see it?" she asked.
Lyndon stopped. He moved back to her, gently placing his hand on her arm. She didn't tremble, but her spirit did.
"We don't have to do this now," he said. "We can come back later."
"It's not his body, is it?"
This was the first time he had seen her hesitate over a dead body. Even when she'd removed her master's sword from his corpse, she hadn't seemed disturbed. Then again, he hadn't known her well back then. He hurried to reassure her.
"It's not. It's just some things he left behind."
Lyndon had waited to tell her exactly what he found because he had expected her to be eager to see for herself, but he had been wrong.
"Do you want me to tell you first?"
Yeren squared her shoulders.
"Nothing to be scared of, is there? He didn't leave a dreadgod tucked away."
Lyndon thought of a shriveled, gray-white mummified hand and hesitated to respond. Yeren saw that.
"Bleed and bury me, if he really—"
No, nothing threatening. But there's no hurry either.
"Doubt either one of us wants to come back into this script longer than we have to. Let's do what we're going to do and be gone."
The suppression field hung heavy on them both, and it hadn't been long since they'd escaped it the first time. Lyndon searched her face, but took her at her word. He focused his will on a barely sensed indentation in space at the back of the room. Then, using a finger of black flame madra as a medium, he cut through it.
"Open,"
Lyndon commanded. The Sword Sage's private void space expanded in front of them. They looked through a rift into a large room filled with collected treasures. Most of the collection seemed to be organized in sections, refining equipment here, training area there, but you could find artwork and swords anywhere. Landscape paintings hung over a rack of nicked wooden swords, while a dancing sculpture of light fluttered beside an overlord-level sword of condensed venom madra. Lyndon had expected Yeren to gasp, or to exclaim, or to make a sound of some kind. Instead, she was silent. When he focused, he realized she had stopped breathing entirely. Her red eyes were wide, her face pale. As a herald, if a partial one, her body and spirit had a unique relationship to one another, one that he didn't quite understand. But even her spirit felt faint, as though her soul was on the verge of dissipating to essence. Lyndon stepped in front of her, blocking the view behind him. She continued to stare.
"Yeren? I need to...
She swallowed.
"Come in with me."
Silently, Lyndon followed her inside. She drifted from one section to another like a wild remnant, from a rack of training manuals to the portrait of a woman Linden recognized as the Winter Sage. For more than 10 minutes, Yaren just floated around, absorbing memories. Finally, she slowed as she approached a rack of black training clothes. Each of them were shredded on the edges, as though they'd been dragged through a thicket of thorns. She ran her fingers over the shreds, the ones she had left herself on these robes as she trained the endless sword and lost control.
"Used to say I'd be ready when I stopped cutting my own clothes. He was going to have me a sword made like his, and I lost his sword. I broke it."
That was when her tears started to flow. Linden didn't say much. He just held her as she cried.
"I wasn't allowed in here,"
she muttered after a few minutes.
"He'd take out what I needed when I needed it. Thought I'd never see these again. Should be dust in the wind."
With another moment surveying the space, she turned to Linden.
"I want it.
I would never leave a scrap behind," he hesitated. "Unless you wanted to, of course."
"My key's not big enough for everything, but we've got space in the house. We can carry it the old way."
"No need for that," Linden said immediately. He had prepared to come back here. Yaren's void key wasn't big enough to hold everything, and neither was his. Fortunately, he had spares. There was only one thing they didn't pack up, a small metal cube marked with a crescent moon that Linden knew from experience contained the hand of Subject One. Linden also held in his palm a small purple-black jewel that had caught his eye. It was clearly a dream tablet of some kind, and he suspected it was a composite gemstone used to hold pieces of several memories instead of one complete experience. Dross could have told him for sure. Without him, Linden had to spend a few minutes scanning through the memories. After a few glimpses and brief words, he was certain, and far more excited. He handed it over to Yaren while he explained. "Your master prepared before he entered the labyrinth. These are some records from other teams who explored the labyrinth first." Yaren's eyes widened as she skimmed the dream tablet herself. It would bear further study, but Linden had come to some conclusions already. First, almost every explorer had gone in alone. Those who did have teams treated them as support crews rather than partners. This made sense based on the other things he had seen. You had to have some degree of control over your willpower to navigate the labyrinth's environment, and the more advanced you were, the harder it was to find companions of equal ability, at least those who wouldn't betray you. Indeed, one of the memories he glimpsed was a 3-man group of archlords who had bickered and betrayed one another after finding a treasure. Only one survivor had escaped, forever spiritually scarred, to leave a dream tablet behind. Yaren noticed the same thing because she grimaced.
"Can't say I'm blind to why my master went in on his own. Not that it's a shock. My hair would have fallen out if he ever worked with a team.
Look at the last memory." It had stuck in Linden's mind, clear enough that it was like Dross had replayed it for him. A man with short, blonde hair and a cropped golden beard sat behind a desk, speaking to the person leaving the memory. There were a few thoughts attached to it. Only his appearance and his words. His looks, like an older version of Aethon, and the lightning crackling behind his blue eyes, had made Linden assume at first glance that this was Tiberian Aurelius.
"You have the backing of House Aurelius to study the labyrinth," the monarch in the memory said. "But I expect you to keep that quiet except at great need. I cannot trust any sage or herald under a monarch's protection, and I'm certain you understand why." "That's clear as new glass," said the man leaving the memory, and his casual drawl made Linden think of Yaren. Linden wished he'd recorded more of his thoughts, because this had to be a personal record of the Sword Sage himself. "Since you're going deeper into the labyrinth than you planned, you might consider taking a team. Just be sure you're only bringing people you trust." The Sword Sage laughed. "I was going alone before I heard a word from you. If you got a list of people who can keep up with me, can be trusted, and are itching to run off across the world on my say-so, I'd love to see it."
Tiberian's posture sagged, and he rubbed his forehead.
I take your point. If I had so many subordinates who were capable, trustworthy, and unified in purpose, I would have no need to employ you. But please, don't risk yourself. My advisors and I are simply testing a theory. We should have many years left before this becomes urgent.
Wouldn't that be a treat? The sword sage muttered.
Linden could see when the memory faded from Yeren because her eyes focused and she scowled into empty space.
Well, isn't this a nest of snakes?
We'll need a good plan, Linden said. Based on his quick glimpse, it felt like half of those who had gone into the labyrinth had failed because of a lack of information. But first, he continued, I think we should take a quick look inside.
Not going to get our faces bitten off for a peek, are we?
Linden slipped the dream tablet into his void key. With some study, he might even be able to make a partial map out of those memories.
Let's find out, he said.
They left the sword sage's void space open and readied themselves for battle, facing down the circular stone door leading into the labyrinth.
Open!
Linden commanded once again. His working crashed against the door and fell apart. Yeren relaxed her grip on her sword.
Try it harder?
This part isn't supposed to be difficult, I'm certain. It's just the outer door. There are outer entrances that underlords can open, and some that open themselves at set times. Linden considered for a moment, then spread his spiritual sense out as far as he could under the suppression of Sacred Valley. He received a clear impression of the underground labyrinth, like a turtle that had entered its shell. It's locked down.
The Titan, you think?
It must be. We'll have to check with Elder Whisper. Linden stared at the outer door, wondering if he could break through it. It would be stupid to try. Even if he succeeded, he would only be exposing Sacred Valley to whatever was inside. But he felt like they had begun a race, only to stumble at the first step.
Huh,
Yeren said.
That's a kick to the face.
Elder Whisper whipped his tails in agitation as he stared at the sealed labyrinth door.
I have read of this reaction, he whispered, and I have seen times when the Nethergate refused to open on time, or when the labyrinth seems to sulk, if you wish to put it that way. The cause is almost always beyond my understanding.
Not so much this time, Yeren said.
Yes, one does assume that the labyrinth has locked itself to prevent further intrusion by the Titan.
A white snout turned in Linden's direction.
What else could it be?
That question bothered Linden greatly. Can we use the hand? He asked. Whisper shook his head.
That tool allows you to borrow the authority of the slumbering wraith and thus command the layers of the labyrinth that he himself controls. If he controlled the outer gates, he would long ago have released himself upon the world.
At least this gives us time to prepare, Linden said, reluctant as he was to give up on entering. I don't think any of us are ready to fight another battle yet, and we can put together all the information we can about what's inside. Elder Whisper sighed.
Poor timing in one sense, but fortunate in another. The Dread Gods have been driven off for the moment, and we need time to settle our people. At least for now, there is no disaster looming over us.
Not that we know, Yeren muttered.
Linden evened his breathing, hoping Elder Whisper was right. The Dread Gods were stirring, but taken care of for the moment. There was no reason to assume anything disastrous would happen, at least for the next few months. Their luck couldn't be that bad. Iteration 001, Sanctum. Suriel connected to the network of Abaddon all over existence. They didn't control nearly as much territory as they did before, and the way was disrupted by chaotic interference everywhere. But she spread her message as widely as she could.
Azriel,
Suriel called.
We need you.
None of the judges had ever done this before. Such an open call could be intercepted by anyone, assuming they were in a world that was still connected to Abaddon control. Making this broadcast was as good as telling the entire cosmos that Azrael was gone, that the Court of Seven had misplaced their greatest weapon. If they hadn't figured it out already, they never would.
Wherever you are, I know you can't see what's happening. You would have returned, unless you really are dead. And then,
she sighed.
I wish you would have trusted me more.
That was too personal for a public broadcast, but it was hard to care. She could see the lights that represented iterations turning gray one by one as the Vroshir extended farther than they ever had before, tightening the noose on Sector 11, on Cradle, on the Abaddon.
They have your scythe. If you could see what they're doing with it, it would break your heart. Come back and tell us what you saw, because if you saw this, and you left anyway...
It wasn't the optimal thing to say to lure Azrael back, but Suriel had to say it. Her voice went cold.
Then I'll execute you myself.
She canceled the connection, and a construct of light like a sapphire spiderweb vanished from in front of her. Her message now traveled through the way between worlds, where it would be received by every Abaddon and every world still connected to reality. In theory. In practice, the amount of chaos the Vroshir were introducing meant she had no idea how far this message would spread. Maybe it still wouldn't reach Azrael, but there weren't many other actions she could take. She wasn't wearing her armor, there not being much chance of combat here in Sanctum. She wore a simple white uniform that her presence materialized for her as she waited here in the headquarters of the Phoenix Division of the Abaddon. All divisions were currently stretched to their absolute limits, but there was a special pressure on the Phoenixes right now. This massive headquarters, with its gleaming white domes the size of a mountain range, was the greatest hospital in existence. There were few things they couldn't heal quickly, so they rarely needed to house many patients. The building's size reflected its importance and the number of staff. Now, the huge edifice was practically empty. She was in her personal quarters at the peak of the central dome, but she was almost the only Abaddon in the entire place. Phoenixes weren't just in charge of healing, but rebuilding. Of the 10 sectors the Abaddon still firmly controlled, not one of them had escaped damage. Members of her 6th Division were even now restoring lives, fending off corruption, and reconstructing entire continents. Where worlds had cracked under spatial assault, her people knitted them back together. She could have joined them as the most capable of their order, but that would require turning her back on the greater wound, the 990 sectors they had abandoned.
Correction, many of those sectors are still within bounds of safe recovery after the Vroshir incursion ends,
her presence reminded her. The ghost of gray smoke hovered next to her, and she may have imagined a slight admonishment in its tone.
Also, the vast majority of those iterations were sparsely inhabited pioneer worlds. The situation is bad enough without embellishing reality.
Of course, the presence was right. Most fully corrupted worlds ended slowly. There would still be trillions of lives left to save after the Vroshir retreated. Arguing with your personal presence was an exercise in futility, but Suriel countered by summoning images all over her room. Windows opened onto many realities, covering the walls, images projected from reports that were delivered to the Abaddon even now. Each of these was from the perspective of an Abaddon agent somewhere calling for assistance, each an image of devastation. An orbital barrage shone from the ground as deadly orange light rained from a steel sky. A deluge of once human monsters swarming up the side of a fortress, the army conducted by a hovering figure in a silver crown. A desperate blur of combat as an Abaddon from the Wolf Division held off a warrior whose spear strikes leveled mountains. The Mad King manifesting into reality, holding a black scythe. That last image was only shown for a moment before an overwhelming tide of blue light as the Abaddon delivering the report escaped. But even in that brief flash, less than a second, Suriel could see the sky behind the Vroshir and the entire iteration crack. There were 1,000 of these, and they covered the room. Suriel faced her presence, though she knew the construct could hear her every thought.
What can we do? She asked. You cannot leave this iteration until Machiel is restored, her presence reminded her. With that restriction, you are limited in what you can accomplish alone.
In her mind, the presence spooled out a list of how she could resolve each of these emergency scenarios, except for the appearance of the Mad King. That was beyond her.
And if I'm not alone? Your highest probability of success comes from cooperating with the other judges in the tasks they are already performing.
Her presence gave her brief glimpses of possibility. Raziel, the wolf, would never leave the battlefield. Joining her would mean putting two of their 7 greatest assets in the same place, but it would also make Raziel far more capable. Together, they could potentially cut off the advance of the Mad King, though still not oppose him directly. Talariel, the spider, wouldn't risk his own life even in the event of total system collapse. He was currently coordinating Abaddon efforts on all fronts, and with Surreal's support, he would have an easier time pushing past chaos, not to mention more willing to take the field, with the greatest healer backing him up. Zakariel, the fox, was more selfish even than Talariel. She had a lot in common with the angler of the Crystal Halls, and each considered the other something of a rival. If it didn't benefit her directly, she usually didn't do it, and she was currently raiding iterations under Vroshir Assault to scoop up any valuables before the world fell, though any Silver Lords that encountered her had no chance of escape. Surreal might persuade the fox to act for the good of the court, which would open coordinated rescue efforts. Surreal could work together with any of the other judges and accomplish great things, but not enough. None of them could stop the advance of the Vroshir. All predictive models showed the same thing. The Mad King cementing his isolation of Sector 11, then moving in for the kill. Once Sector 11 was in ruins, he would retreat before even he was cut off by the chaos he'd left in his wake. Then he'd leave the Abaddon to clean up after him. No 2 judges could stop him. Without Machiel, no 2 could even fight him. But what about 3?
What are my odds of getting 2 other judges to work with me against the Vroshir directly? Not high.
Surreal preferred her presence to answer numerically where possible, even when regarding scenarios that were technically incalculable. When it didn't, that meant the scenario was truly uncertain.
It is a shame that those who rise to become judges tend to be unusually individualistic, her presence continued. Forceful, difficult to persuade, even with objective facts.
Surreal stroked the ghostly gray correlation lines that ran from the back of her skull to her knuckles like strings of smoke.
It will be difficult to get them to abandon their individual pursuits, but not impossible. Is there any other chance of victory? If you define victory as preserving as many of those under our protection as possible, then a defensive engagement has the highest probability of success. Taking conservative action and retaining territory until the Vroshir incursion ends gives us the best chance of reclaiming as many worlds as possible almost 100% of the time. And what if I define victory as forcing the Vroshir incursion to end early? It is a shame that those who rise to become judges tend to be unusually individualistic, her presence repeated. Forceful, difficult to persuade, even... Connect me to the Titan,
Surreal interrupted. With a faint sigh, her presence obeyed. Chapter 3. Within the corrupted lands of the desolate wilds, there were only a few livable pockets in which the dread beasts and the blight of venom aura had been pushed back. A few years ago, Linden had found an alliance of 5 factions formed around the emergence of the transcendent ruins, but that had only been temporary. The town in which the residents of Sacred Valley found shelter was called, quite simply, Refuge. It had started off as a temporary camp, but that had been years ago. Recently, it had been home to thousands, and some homes had housed families for 3 generations. But that was before the attack of the Wandering Titan. Now the town was half empty, and signs of battle against the tide of dreadbeasts marred the walls and littered the streets. The buildings had only survived thanks to their own good fortune. Attacks from dread gods or monarchs had carved new ravines into the territory all around. The townsfolk, though, were anything but grateful for their survival. Everyone had lost someone. Many had lost homes, and now they were facing an influx of refugees from the west. As Lyndon had expected, they would have violently rejected the people from Sacred Valley. Would have, except that the most advanced experts in the region were True Gold. Even Jai Long could toy with the most powerful people here. Not only did they keep their complaints down, but they would do anything to keep the mighty strangers here. There was a sense of security from curling up next to the strong. So far, it was within Lyndon's expectations. But once again, he wished he had Dross to talk to, because he had begun seeing strange flags pop up everywhere in and around Refuge, and he was afraid he knew who was responsible for them. "Where did these flags come from, Ethan?" Lyndon asked the air. A few nearby people shot him strange looks, but they kept about their business. They hadn't met him yet, and once again, they couldn't sense anything through his veil. Ethan could hear him. He was close enough, and Lyndon knew he was paying attention. The flags came in many colors, but they all had one symbol, a starburst with one half red or orange and the other half blue. Both halves were melded roughly as though they'd been fused together. He hadn't paid much attention to it at first until he overheard a name attached to the symbol, the Sect of Twin Stars. "Ethan, what's the Sect of Twin Stars?" A girl his own age came to a stop when she heard him speak. She was a low gold with a blue hurricane gold sign swirling around one wrist, and she zipped over to him as though he'd called her by name. Too late, he saw that she was wearing the same two-colored starburst symbol newly sewn onto her robes.
"Are you interested in the Sect of Twin Stars?" she asked excitedly. "They'll take just about anyone, you know. It doesn't matter what path you're on. And they have teachers you wouldn't believe. The sect founder is a sage. I don't know what he's doing here, but they say if you're a loyal member of the sect, they'll take you east with them when they leave."
Lyndon felt like he was trapped in some kind of bizarre illusion, but he still responded automatically.
"Gratitude, where did you learn about this sect?"
"Oh, they're telling everybody. You can go see for yourself. There's a big blue cloud ship to the north where you can go and apply, and if you're accepted, you'll get an elixir right away."
She straightened herself and said proudly,
"With their support, they say I can make True Gold in a year, and—"
She darkened as she added,
"And we won't have to stay around here anymore."
"I see." He dipped his head. "Apologies for taking up your time."
He didn't ask her name because he didn't want to give his own, but he marked her face. He didn't know if Ethan was serious about taking these people away from Refuge, but he would make sure she, at least, got a spot. When he arrived at the north side of town, his suspicions were confirmed. Sure enough, the blue cloud ship was Windfall, with Ethan's portion of the island, the part covered in crops, angled toward Refuge. A huge crowd had gathered at the edge of the giant blue cloud, encircling a few young men and women who were proudly displaying sewn-on badges of the Twin Star sect. Standing on the top of the cloud, half of his body still wrapped in bandages, was Ethan.
"Stand proud, new acolytes of the Twin Star sect," Ethan cried.
He sounded more energetic than anyone so injured should be.
"We have chosen you to receive training from the best of the best, so that you may reach heights undreamt of."
The crowd applauded, and the new recruits looked smug, but Lyndon was starting to wonder if this was all some elaborate prank on Ethan's part. He activated the soul cloak for just a moment, kicking off and soaring over the crowd. When he landed next to Ethan, the Archlord swept a very stiff bow to the people down below.
"Now I must bid you farewell, as the time has come for me to confer with our founder and patriarch, the Sage of Twin Stars."
Ethan ushered Lyndon toward Lyndon's own home as the crowd cheered below.
"What?"
Lyndon asked.
"I feel like you've already pieced it together accurately," Ethan said.
He sagged down onto his personal thousand-mile cloud, groaning as he did. He made a gesture as though to brush hair away from his face, but grimaced as he found his hair short.
"You created a sect in my name."
"That I did. It was something of a bluff, but you know how it is. Sometimes these things get away from you."
"I don't know how to lead a sect."
"I, of course, considered that you might feel that way. Not a problem at all. I would just like to borrow your image as a figurehead. That might work even better in its own way. You could be the enigmatic, mysterious expert backing our operations from the shadows."
Linden gave Ethan a sidelong glance, but the man looked perfectly sincere.
Apologies, but I thought you would try to trick me into doing it.
Linden, Linden, Linden! How dare you say something so hurtful and yet so accurate?
Linden continued staring at him, and Ethan's usual smile faded a bit.
Believe it or not, I had intended to consult you first. I had a plan for a grand reveal and everything. You do like tiger meat, don't you? Anyway, events got ahead of me, and I had to work quickly to bail out of a complicated situation. I do apologize.
Linden shook his head.
No need.
What? This is perfect. Linden's mind was whirling.
We had to keep borrowing the name of House Aurelius or the Akura clan, but now we can act on our own. You know what we can do with an organization behind us?
Besides,
he winced as his enthusiasm was too much for his fractured remnant arm.
You taught me my cycling technique and guided me in my pure Madra techniques. You have more right to the path of Twin Stars than anyone but me, and Dross.
Ethan looked from his own bandages to Linden's sling.
If I hugged you right now, would that put an awkward strain on our relationship?
It would certainly strain our injuries.
Then just know that I embrace you in spirit.
Ethan settled down on his cloud.
As you can imagine, many of the people around here no longer have anywhere to belong, and no one in several hundred miles has ever had a real sacred arts education. We need teachers and refiners and more resources, but most of all, we need somewhere to settle that doesn't have the word desolate in its name, or dread gods lurking nearby.
I assume we'll use whatever portal you brought Windfall through.
That hadn't even struck Linden as odd. When he'd seen the Cloud Fortress appear out of nowhere, Ethan's presence had been the only explanation Linden needed. Clearly, Ethan had set up some kind of transportation between here and Moongrave, or had bartered with the Monarch. Ethan became interested in his own fingernails.
As eager as I am to claim credit for that, it actually crawled out of a shadow without warning or explanation. I begin to wonder if Malice has some kind of grudge against me.
Why, sending the fortress back was a favor.
It was my shadow that it popped out of.
Presumably Linden's family had been aboard. He could sense them nearby. Not that their presence was entirely a relief. They would have been perfectly safe in Moongrave.
They should have room for us in the Black Flame Empire, Linden said.
Narusea suggested the Emperor was very pleased with us. Ethan sighed.
Yes, it does, and just between you and me and any monarchs that happen to be eavesdropping on us, I suspect they'll be sending some cloud ships for us soon. They won't have missed a Dreadgod's rampage, and they know we were involved. Naru Huan has an opportunity, but we would be the most powerful beings in the Empire by a huge margin. Our presence could change the entire landscape of the nation, not to mention their relationship with the Akura clan.
Linden chewed on that for a long moment. If he wasn't qualified to lead a sect, he certainly didn't feel qualified to give his opinion on international politics. Then again, he was a sage now.
Moving to the Empire solves our problems, Linden said at last. If they want us to leave later, we can, but there are too many people here, and even clean water is expensive. We have to move.
We do, but relocating into the Black Flame Empire will cause much to change. There's no telling how everything will fall out.
Ethan paused.
I withdraw my objections. That sounds exciting.
They were only a few steps from Linden's house, but instead of drifting up to the door, Ethan led his thousand-mile cloud to the edge of the floating island. He looked down onto the twisted green and black trees of the desolate wilds. People were camped everywhere, crammed into shacks, hasty walls and scripts protecting them. The protections didn't look like they would survive a stiff breeze in the night, much less an actual attack. Of course, if there was an actual attack from anything less than a monarch, Linden would sense it coming from miles away and take care of it before any of those below were in any real danger. But he couldn't be everywhere all the time.
This is what a sect is for, Ethan said. We can't do everything. At some point, they have to protect themselves.
Linden watched an iron man from Sacred Valley bowing to a low-gold child from the wild, and he nodded. Without someone around who was underlord or better, the first true gold-level dreadbeast to attack would tear through this crowd like a wolf through sheep. And he could sense the tension quivering in the air like a vibration in the vital aura. These people had all lived through a Dread God rampage, and they never knew when it might return. The only ones who looked confident were those wearing the Sect of Twin Stars logo. They belonged to an organization that would survive, one that could protect them.
I see, London said.
I thought you would.
Orthos hovered over the black, corrupted trees of the desolate wilds, just outside the camp the refugees from Sacred Valley were using for shelter. The turtle was suspended on flows of vital aura, scripts directing life aura to him to regenerate his wounds. Linden looked up from the shadow as the giant sacred beast blotted out the sun. Orthos rotated in the air, one smoldering red and black eye rolling to see Linden.
Tell these children to lower me to the ground. I can stay still myself.
A team of 16 True Gold elders, the best the region had to offer, sweated and labored over scripts and natural treasures. They stared at Orthos with fear, but toward Linden they demonstrated only polite respect. They could sense how powerful Orthos was, and at the moment he was almost half the size of a Dread God. He could roll over and crush a town. As for Linden, if he didn't remove his veil, they couldn't feel his power at all. As far as they knew, he may have just been a jade. But his powerful friends treated him well, so they followed suit. Linden controlled Wind Aura to levitate up to Orthos so they could speak eye to eye. He looked down to survey the True Golds, who were slightly more impressed now that they had seen his skilled control of aura, although this was nothing a gold on a wind path couldn't do.
They're working under Aethan's instructions, Linden pointed out. I doubt they'd listen to me unless I forced them.
Orthos grumbled, which sent a covey of startled birds fluttering into the air.
It's good luck for them that I'm not in a bad mood. If I broke this formation, I'd squash them.
Some True Golds went pale and stepped back. Orthos couldn't keep his voice down when he was big enough to swallow cloud ships. Now that you're awake, Linden hesitated, unsure how to phrase his thoughts properly. I've heard of giant sacred beasts, and I knew you were going to transform, but how... Orthos laughed, and several of the gold lost their feet.
Bigger than you expected.
I thought you'd be a dragon, Linden admitted.
What do you call someone who violates their own soul?
Orthos asked.
What do you call a trash human who does something that no one with a conscience would ever consider? You say they're inhuman, don't you? It's your actions that determine what you are on the inside.
He raised his head proudly.
I'm more dragon than any of those proud gold dragons who ambushed you like cowards, and I gained this control over my body when I accepted that I was in the form that suited me best.
I am grateful to have you back in any form, Linden said, but I do admit I was afraid I wouldn't recognize you.
The lot of you need a shell more than you need fangs and claws.
Orthos glanced down at himself.
But, I didn't realize it would take so much soul fire to grow, and just as much to shrink.
Linden had a little experience in the subject.